I want to talk to you this morning for a little bit. I want to have some fun. I want to talk to you about getting thinner. Probably a bunch of you would like to just head out the door right now, right? You're like, whoa. Come on. Dude, cut us a break. It's the holidays, right? But thinner in a way that perhaps you don't think about. There is. Jared, you can throw up that Celtic cross. I want to talk about the Celtics. No. We say the Celtics, but the word is actually pronounced Celtic, right? Celtic culture is an amazing culture, a very spiritual culture. Literally, historically, there is great truth. Some stuff is legend. We know that. We can show that. Unfortunately, some people believe in legends, and some people, and then there's truth, and some people can understand and see the truth. Truth is, in some ways, the Irish saved civilization, depending on how you want to define civilization. But when it comes to Western civilization, they actually did. I mean, this deal with St. Patrick is a real story. It's a real deal. He was an English boy that got kidnapped by a Celtic tribe and taken back to Ireland. And it was a very warring and violent and as well as spiritual and pagan nation. Now, when I use the word pagan, don't think I'm trying to make fun of somebody. It's just a term that is used in anthropology, sociology, and culture and history. It was a pagan nation. It had a plethora of different practices and religious practices indigenous to their own area. And that's what it means when we say that. But it's and you can have good pagans and you can have bad pagans, just like you can have great Christians and Christians that are real schmucks. And I personally think God would rather hang out with a great pagan than a schmuck Christian any day, you know? And I think he does. I think sometimes people that we would say, well, they're pagan, whatever, you know, or they're not in touch with, well, they're actually really, really in touch with God. I mean, I think that about sometimes with atheists. I think I've met atheists that, in my opinion, are really in touch with God, whether they believe in God or not. That may sound funny to you, but stick that in your pocket and think about it, because they may not believe in God, but God believes in them, and God is with them, and there's a rhythm in there. Last week we talked about rhythm, right? The rhythm of the universe, the rhythm of life, the rhythm that's a spiritual rhythm. And we talked about being in tune. And last week was really fun. If you weren't here last week, I asked if anybody had never played an instrument and thought of themselves as having really no sense of rhythm. And we had hands go up, and then I think they regretted it the moment they did that. They just kind of went, oop, you know. And then I called on them, and I got five people up, and we each gave them an instrument, and we told them to play. And it was just... Well, I was going to say it was really awful noise. It was noise. It wasn't as awful as I thought it would be, though. I mean, you know, I thought it would really be awful. Then banging on the piano and just hitting the guitar, but that was noise. And then we got the band back up and we got them to play, and we talked about the fact that the difference between noise and music, rhythm, is the pauses in between. It's syncopation. It's the pauses between the notes that give us, there's a distinct thought process that goes into creating music versus noise. And sometimes our lives are like that. Sometimes our lives just get really noisy and we've lost the rhythm. And we find that rhythm with God. Even with the 6-in-1 poem of creation, the rhythm of Shabbat, Sabbath, a day of rest, a day of like, okay, the world is still going to spin. I need to chill for a moment, realize bigger things are taking place. Well, St. Patrick, Patrick was kidnapped. He came back. He escaped, actually went back to England and was a young man of faith and decided to go to the priesthood. And he went into the priesthood and he had a burden. Interestingly, he had a burden for these people that had enslaved them and kidnapped them. And he wanted to go back and share the love and grace of Jesus with them. And he actually did that. And there was a massive conversion experience that took place in Ireland. And he used wisely things that were already inherent to their faith practices. The number 3 was huge, so the 3-leaf Clover was a big example for him to talk about the Trinity of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit and being connected and one being three and three being one. So there's actually truth to this stuff. And the Irish became an amazingly brilliant, hardworking community of monks, and they built monasteries, and they became amazing students of languages. They were able to learn the Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek languages. And what they did, they got so into writing, they were so learned, they loved to write and copy manuscripts, not just the Bible, but anything else. So they took the great writings of Aristotle and Socrates and Plato, and they took all the great literature in the world, and they copied it and copied it and copied it right before the Dark Ages hit, when the Vandals, the Huns, the Visigoths, and the Dark Ages hit, and it was really a time of terror, and literally all the kind of bastions of civilization were burned. All the books, all the libraries, all the places of learning were destroyed by the Goths and the Vandals during the Dark Ages, except solitarily for these monasteries that kept these ancient writings alive. And they attribute every copy of today, of every ancient writing at one point, survives today because it survived on the island of Ireland with these monks who had copied them and had not been pillaged. It's a fascinating, fascinating story. There's also a deep spirituality that we call Celtic spirituality. You see a Celtic cross. And the Celtics, in their experience there, also coined a phrase. And they would say that there are certain places that were thin places. That's the thing that they would use, thin places. And what do they mean by that? They meant there were certain places, geographically, literally, physical places, that you would be or that you could go to, that they said that the membrane between heaven and earth was just thinner. Right? So the concept was heaven is up there and out there and the spiritual world and God, but we're here down in the terrestrial world. But there are these places that you can go to where all of a sudden what is maybe what feels, you know, a wall that's 3 feet thick all of a sudden becomes paper thin and you experience heaven on earth. And they would mark these places with stones, or they would build chapels, or they would be, Iona is one of them. But these places became known as thin places, and they would describe it as places where you experience God. Now, if we look at the Bible, the story, I want to use that metaphor of thin place. That's why I want to talk about getting thinner. The Bible starts out with this beautiful creation poem, and the poem reaches its zenith in the seventh day, which is a day of rest and Shabbat. And the creation of man, and for the first thing after everything being good, God created everything and it's good. Tov, 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 seven times. The first not good thing happens in the Bible, and that is man is alone as the story unfolds. In other words, isolation and loneliness is not a good thing, and God creates man and woman. He creates relationship, and he creates community. As far as the Bible goes, I would say, as far as the narrative, the first thin place, you couldn't get any thinner, might be the scene of the Garden of Eden, Gan Eden. You can't get any thinner, because in the narrative, Adam and Eve walk with God. God is there. In other words, his presence is there with them. That's a thin place. And of course we know as the story unfolds, the beaker spills, a virus breaks out, this chain reaction takes place, and they're put outside of the garden, and now the story takes a new direction. But I would say that certainly the garden was a place of thinness, where God was present with people. Now, as the story unfolds in Genesis, we know Abraham is chosen. And I would say all through the Bible, we could use that metaphor of thin places where God comes in contact. So it's not isolated here and there. But I'm going to just kind of hit some spots. Abraham has a son, Isaac, and Isaac has a son, Jacob, but Jacob has a brother, and Esau, and you remember there's this conflict between the two brothers, and he steals his birthright. Jacob, his name means deceiver, Yaakov, in the Hebrew means deceiver. He deceives his brother, and he pretends to be him, and he steals, the younger brother steals the older brother's birthright, and the older brother is hacked, and he wants to kill him, so he takes off on the run, and he's in the desert. He's running for his life from his own brother. And Jared, if we can show Genesis 20, what was it, number 28, was it, Jared? I think it was 28, 6, something like that. Can't remember. Oh, here it is. Oh, yeah, so it's in chapter 28. Anyway, he's on the run. He's in the desert. And he is really, I mean, his life is falling apart. Everything has changed radically. And he has nobody. And as he's in the desert, he lays down to sleep, and he puts his head on a rock as a pillow. And these are powerful metaphors, you know. They're going, your pillow is a rock, you know. I mean, that speaks to me. It's not a very comfortable thing, and it really speaks of, like, this is not going to be a good night's sleep. And all of a sudden, he has a dream, and it says he saw a stairway. And the Hebrew there kind of means a ladder, which gets confusing. But yeah, think about a ladder. And it was resting on the earth with its top reaching up to heaven, and the angels were ascending and descending on it. And God speaks to him, and he says, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and the east and the north and the south, and all the people on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring, your children. And then he says to him, and I am with you, Jacob, and I will watch over you wherever you go. And Jacob, I'm going to bring you back to this Eretz, the land. And Jacob, I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. And then it says, when Jacob awoke from his sleep, he thought, surely the Lord is in this place, and I didn't know it. Is that so cool? I love that. He was like, he's in this place, and I didn't know it. And he builds an altar there, and he calls it Bethel. Bethel means the house of God, the dwelling place of God, in the desert, in the middle of nowhere, on the dirt, with a rock for a pillow, pursued by his brother who wants to kill him, everything that he's had lost. He lies stripped, alone, in the desert, and God says, I'm with you, right where you're at, a thin place. And he uses that statement, and he's like, man, God was here. I didn't even know it. And yet he was right here, watching over me. I like that metaphor of thin place that the Celtic spiritual fathers gave us. And if you go through the Bible, it continues. You will see later Jacob is pursued again, and he's going to meet his brother, and he's so scared. And it's the night before the meeting, and in the middle of the night, he encounters God, and he ends up, it's really amazing literature, just the way it's written. It's just mind-blowing stuff. It's so beautiful. And he ends up in a wrestling match with God. And he literally wrestles with God all night long. And it's weird because it ends up, after an entire night of wrestling, it ends up a tie. And finally in the story, God wants to leave. He's like, and Jacob grabs onto his leg, you know, and I get this vision of him like, oh, I'm going already, let me go. He's like, no, you can't go. You can't leave me until you bless me. And he blesses him, and he touches him on the hip, and it dislocates his socket, and he's like, I'm blessing you. Ooh. He goes, but part of the way you're going to remember I blessed you is you're going to walk with a limp for the rest of your life. Isn't that great writing? Oh, thank you, God. Yeah, I'm blessed. It's so beautiful. It's so amazing. And yet the power of these words, they soak into us today. How many of us in our life have found after the fact that we went through something crippling and then we were blessed by it? And we may even still bear the scars of it in some way, shape, or form, emotionally, physically, otherwise. But we got through to the other side, and God was really with us. We didn't even know it, but He was there. We get to the other side, we look back, we go, wow. I still have that limp, but my God, I wouldn't trade it for anything, because that was a thin place. I encountered God. I think of that movie, The Apostle. Remember the Apostle, that movie, with brilliant movie with Robert Duvall? Preacher gone bad, so to speak. He kills a guy, manslaughters him in rage, and now he's on the run. He's at his mom's house, and he's up in his bedroom, and he's railing with God, just screaming at him. And there's a big storm outside, and he's just screaming and yelling at God. And the phone rings, and the mom's in the bed, and she wakes up, you know, and she picks up the phone, and it's a neighbor. Wow, wow, wow. She goes, oh, yeah, sorry about the noise. That's just my son. Was he? Yeah, he's praying. Yeah. Well, sometimes he talks to God, and sometimes he yells at him. It's just like fantastic. And in a sense, it's that Jacob. He's just like, he's wrestling with God. Like, God, don't let me. I'm not leaving until I know you're there. Till you bless me. So we see that. And then, of course, we get places that are pretty common that we all know, like Moses. The redemptive story is now taking place in the Exodus, and Moses is a guy on the run, too, because he killed somebody. Is that hilarious? You won't write stories like this and make your heroes these awful people, I mean, if you can do this by design. So Moses is a murderer. He's on the lam. He's out in the desert. And he's been out there for years, 40 years, and all of a sudden he sees a bush that's burning. And he walks over to it, and he hears a voice, and it's the voice of God saying, take off your sandals. You're standing on holy ground. I always wondered about what that meant, to take off your sandals. Of course, it's still a tradition in many cultures today, in mosques today across the world. Muslims have looked at that, and they have said, you know, when you enter a holy place, a holy site, a thin place, you take your sandals off. And I don't know why he did that. I've often thought deeply about it. I've never found anything that has nailed it down, that this is what's meant by that. But I have my own theories, you know. Part of me thinks, like, he wants him to take the sandals off because he doesn't want anything man-made in between him and the soil. I mean, he wants intimacy. He wants, and I don't know if you're like that, but some people are more tactile that way. I'm up on Shelf Road, and I see people walking with bare feet on Shelf Road. And they call that something. Anybody know? Calluses, right. For me, I'm a tenderfoot. I can barely get the paper without, I couldn't do it. No, they call it grounding. Max in the grounding, right? There's something about taking your shoes off and stepping in the park. I mean, what was that? Oh, Pretty Woman. I love that movie where, yeah, Richard Gere, she's like, take off your shoes, take off your socks. He's just Mr. Strict Businessman in the suit, piling on, building empires. And all of a sudden he's like, maybe since he was a kid, he's in a park on grass with bare feet, and he's just kind of like, huh. Or maybe you get to the beach and you love to take the shoes off and you just take your, and you soak and the water hits your feet. There's something grounding. I also thought that, what do you think shoes were made of during those days? Leather, right? What is leather? It's a dead animal. Leather is a product of death. Leather is a reminder in the ancient story of the Garden of Eden, where things went bad and God had to clothe naked Adam and Eve, and the first death enters into the narrative, the death of an animal, because it wasn't a part of the program, and skins were made. And to this day, we know in Judaism, it's always a reminder. You eat meat, for example. Jews are very, very aware that meat is not what's supposed to be. It's an allowance. That's why there's kosher dietary laws. But it's not what's supposed to be. As a matter of fact, in the restored world of the vision of Isaiah, the lion and the lamb, they lie together, lion and lamb. There is no more animal killing animal. So this is the vision of restoration, lion and lamb together. A child can pull a viper out of its hold because there is no more death, animal kingdom, dog-eat-dog world that ends. So I thought about that. I thought, well, maybe that's it. He just wants this incredible intimacy. Yeah. You don't want to make love wearing a wetsuit. It's not very intimate. You want intimacy, skin on skin. And there's something here about the ground. Even as I think about Jacob lying on the ground, he says, the ground you're lying on, the very ground you're grounding with. I'm going to keep my promise. So these are thin moments. Of course, we look at it. He takes them to Mount Sinai. They get the Ten Commandments. You saw the movie, Charlton Heston, The Lord Thy God. And he's got the, and all that takes place, thin moment. They follow pillars of clouds and fire. And ultimately, they're told instructions to build a tabernacle, which means what? A tent, a building. The tabernacle becomes the place where God dwells with his people. It becomes a physical thin place that they take with them through the desert, and ultimately becomes the temple in Jerusalem, whose mount, whose foundation stones exist to this day. And I'd say in the Bible narrative, the temple becomes a massive thin place. Now, when we think of thin places, I mean, sometimes we think of them as being very remote and isolated. And there's a truth to that, right? When we go on retreat, or somebody goes on a retreat, whether it's an individual or a church retreat or whatever, we stick the youth. Where do we send the youth? We send them up to the mountains to get away from all the clutter, the noise. There's something about retreat, seclusion, nature that becomes a thin spot. And maybe you've experienced that when you're hiking or you're seeing a sunset or you're just out there, and all of a sudden the clutter and the noise starts becoming a rhythm, and you can hear and you can breathe again. There's absolute truth to that. Jesus himself would often, the gospel tells, retreat to a lonely place. I mean, think about that. Jesus had to get away. Jesus had to get away from it all. I mean, that tells me something, right? He had to get away from it all, and he had to get isolated. And so maybe he'd just be alone and hear and get in touch. And these places sometimes become known as thin places. Now, but I'm going to submit some other thoughts to you on that as well. Now, the temple was like church. And you could say in our church history, there is a desire to make church a thin place. I'm hoping in some way, shape, or form that when you come on a Sunday, somewhere, somehow, the contact for you spiritually between heaven and Monday morning gets a little thinner. And certainly we try to do that. The temple does that. But it doesn't mean that it's always quiet, right? The temple was noisy. There were animals being slaughtered. There was blood flowing, horns blasting. It was like a mall full of people coming and going and praying and chanting and talking and selling and everything else. I mean, Jesus went crazy, apparently, at the temple. At one point, he tries to shut the freaking thing down. I mean, he's just like, this is supposed to be a house of prayer for all nations, and you've turned it into a den of thieves. He just calls out the church. You don't understand why they didn't like him, right? He just calls them out. And in fact, if we think about that, let's back up for a moment, because if there's another pivotal, maybe garden-like thin moment, we have this thin moment with Jesus' birth, the incarnation. God, Emmanuel, comes with us. God is with us. And that's maybe why this season is such a great time. I've always loved Christmas. I was not raised in the church. I didn't go to church as a kid. I'm going to tell you what, though. I remember this movie as a kid back in the 60s, watching Charlie Brown, who was my hero, and Charlie Brown Christmas came, and little Chuck you know, was being laughed at about the tree and everything else, and he screams out, you know, doesn't anybody tell me the commercialization, Snoopy's got the whole shebang going. And little Linus tells him what Christmas is all about. And I remember, maybe even as a young boy, I had a thin moment. I was like, ah. And I loved Christmas. And I always have, and I always do, and I always will. It's a great season for everybody. It disturbs me, I'll be very honest with you, and I don't mean to offend, but offend I do. these Christians that go crazy on this war on Christmas. My God, say Merry Christmas, not Happy Holidays. These people who are just on a constant rant to reclaim Christmas, fighting for Christmas, arguing for Christmas, boycotting that store that says Happy Holidays. I'm just like, freaking chill out. Jesus is the reason that you should be the least offended person in the world. Not the most insecure and constantly offended person. You should be the lightest stepping, no, and enjoy the holiday. It's a beautiful time. It's a thin moment for many people. And there's just something about that. And yes, we get caught in the materialism, the buying. I mean, we talk about that. We know that. We all get trapped into that. But still, there's something about Christmas. There's something about just smiling at people and maybe even having an excuse to talk to a stranger and say Merry Christmas or give them a little greeting. And there's something there. It's a thin moment. Don't ruin it for people by trying to own it and corner it and have... No. I mean, we should be the least offended and most generous and happy people, not walking around always screaming about it. But certainly... Hey, and the glory of the Lord shone round about men. Right? The angels descended, Jesus is born, and then the narrative story of the nativity, they sing and they say, well, they don't actually sing, it doesn't say that, but anyways, that's a different story. But anyways, they simply say, glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace and goodwill toward men. It's a thin moment, and these shepherds run out. Jesus is in the world. He's come in. And now a thin moment becomes personified. I just kind of believe that Jesus was a walking, talking thin moment. And people that encountered him, there was a portal, a hole that was punched between heaven and earth. And some of the golden drops of heaven seeped down and dropped right onto the earth where he went. And he showed us the way it was supposed to be. And the people that he healed, and the people that he touched, and the people that he loved, and the people that he forgave and cleansed. Wow. Walking, talking, thin spot Jesus is. His death and resurrection leads him to empower us. The ascension is a powerful moment, a confusing one. It's always a disturbing one. You know, I'm better with it now, but before I used to think like it's so kind of like cheesy, you know. We're up on the Mount of Olives. Jesus talks to his disciple, and then he's just like, you know, up, up, and away. And he disappears before their eyes, you know, and I'm like, wow, okay. But there's something about, I love that part where they're all looking up, and all of a sudden this angel interrupts them and says, what are you looking at? Like, and I kind of get it. Like, where'd he go? What's the deal? You know, he's gone now. Now it's up to you. Oh, what? Yeah, you got work to do. There's a mission, because his plan was a propagation by dandelion effect. They killed them by blowing on them like a dandelion. But what happened is that 10,000 seeds went out, and now the thin spots are going to multiply, and they're going to multiply through you. This is what I would submit to you. I would submit to you that the plan from Jesus' perspective was that through him and the Spirit and his life, his death, his resurrection, and the Spirit and in endowing us with the Spirit, is that now we are going to punch holes all around the world through you. One of the most disturbing things to the Romans about this problematic cult, the Christian cult that was sprouting up, something that was maddening to them was, check this out, they didn't have a temple. Everybody's got a temple. What did they do to the Jews? The Jews were the perennial pain in the butt. There was a love-hate relationship between Rome and the Jews because they were so productive, but they were a constant pain. There was always these... It's like that little kid who just thinks he can take you, but you know you could punch him out. But all of a sudden he comes up and he punches you right in the nuts, and you're like, dang it, I'm going to kill that kid. And, you know, but then finally they just do. And what? And how do they do that in 70 A.D.? They destroy the temple. In fact, Jesus, in this prophetic sense, although I don't think it was a hard thing to predict, I think a lot of, you know, if there were, you know, political op-ed pages going, would say, listen, we continue on this course, the whole thing's going to go up in flames. He said it, and it happened. 70 A.D., it was gone, eradicated. But what was interesting about the Jesus movement was it wasn't necessary for it to have a temple, because it said the temple is you, and the Spirit of God is in you. And Jesus said the kingdom of God is where? In you. You are living and breathing temples. So all of a sudden, where did this thin place come when a bunch of people got together at someone's home? That was church. Because the church isn't a building. The church is a body of people. Living and breathing people who are punching holes between here and heaven and letting it leak right where we're at. There were no temples for the early Christians. It was confounding. How could a religion not have a temple? Of course, we've gotten back into the business of building temples. Don't get me wrong. No, it happened, you know, pretty quickly. And I'm not saying that there's anything wrong. I mean, if you look at some of the great I've been to Notre Dame and some of these cathedrals. Although we look at it, and there's a real horrific story sometimes behind these things to build these edifices for God. I mean, and we still struggle with that today. But ultimately, the church is not a building, but it's supposed to be a thin place. And we have a building, and we're thankful for that. There's nothing wrong with that. Don't get me wrong. Don't hear me say that I think it's a really awful thing to have a building. I'm saying it's at least potentially awful, and for me, it is always, always a grind. It's hard for me. There is always this tension, this cognitive dissonance of like, do we sink money into the building? Do we not sink money in the building? Do we really need this for the building? Do we not really need this for the building? You know, it's hard for me. And I know for some people it really is like, well, why don't we have new couches? And why don't we got this stinking carpet? And why don't we got... And I get it. I know that because I go to people's homes and it's bitching. And I love that. And I'm jealous. And I wish I had that. And if we had the money and we were rolling in the dough, it might not be, you know, a big deal. But for me, it's always like, God, should we put the $1,000 into that, or should we try to keep that family housed for another month? Yeah, I'm thinking we're going with the housing thing. Okay, so the new carpet or the new chair or the remodel can wait. And we do that around here, and sometimes people get frustrated, and I understand that. This is falling apart. Yeah, I know. Well, I get it. And then sometimes, you know, so that's a constant tension that I have. Churches can be thin places, but they can also be thick places. I think ultimately, that's what I'm talking about, is when I think about thickness and thinness, I think that while there is no doubt that we go to certain places and we just get in touch with God, and that's a good thing, I recommend it, find it. And if you don't have it, maybe actually you do, but you need to cultivate it more. Maybe it really is that just going to Shelf Road and looking at the valley, or it's getting home from work and sitting out on your porch and having a beer and looking at the view where you just like, oh, I'm having a moment. Rhythm, thinness. Maybe it is getting on the backpacking trail and you go up and you got to get up and you got to get away and you got to get alone where it's just stark. Nothing, and it's just you, or you go out to the desert. That is really good and understandable. Those are portals that can punch through, and we can get retuned up. But the point of that isn't just self-gratification or having a moment. The point of that is to be retuned And then when we come off the hill or off the porch, we come back into the world and we become the thin place. We are the thin spot. We are walking. The church is holy. And that, I mean, it's punching holes all through and letting heaven leak down on people. So when we build a home for Homes of Hope, or we give a cup of water in God's name, when you do the things that you do, I want you to know thin spots between heaven and earth are breaking forth. It's pouring out. That is what it's about, and it feels good. I want to encourage you when you leave. I want you to encourage you when you go into your Monday grind, whether you go to work or whether you go to school or whether you're going to go have fun or you go on vacation. I want to encourage you to begin to realize you are the thin place. And anytime we open ourselves to that, man, heaven pours out. God was around and I didn't even know it. Kathy, I know you're horrified, but I want to ask you to come up for a second. She's hoping I forgot. I know you were hoping the whole time I forgot. But we were just recently, hit this, Joshy, in Las Vegas. And I have fun in Las Vegas. I really do. Because I like people. And you see all kinds of people. And Las Vegas, for me, believe it or not, is a real thin spot. People go, what? Oh, come on, Vegas, it's the noise. No. It becomes a thin spot because there's people there. And I remember once I was in the casino. Joshua, remember, this is here too. I'm walking in the casino, and there's this black brother walking towards me, and I'm walking towards him, and I look, I had a hat on. He's like, nice hat. I'm like, yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. And I just looked at him, and I just saw something in his eyes. I just looked at him, and he just looked at me. And then he came over, and I looked at him, and he's like, my dad just died. I'm like, whoa, brother, I lost my mom and my dad just recently. I know what that feels like. He doesn't know me from Adam. And he gets in close and he starts to tear up. And I give this guy a hug and I just whispered a prayer in his ear. And freaking ching, 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 ching. We're in a casino. It was paper thin. Paper thin. A moment with a stranger. Kathy had some of these moments that we talked about in Vegas recently. Shh, you can tell them in your own words and pump her up because she's probably trying to breathe. Take a breath.
Okay.
Take a breath.
Oh, geez. So, well, I'm sitting on the couch last night. It was about 11 o'clock, I think. I'm playing Candy Crush and Paul's working on the sermon in the back. And he's like, hey, I'm going to need you to share tomorrow. And I'm like, you're kidding, right? And he's like, no, I'm totally serious.
Horrified.
So that was 11 o'clock last night, and here
it's
I am. So anyway, we were in Vegas, and we go to the hotels and cruise around and went to the movie theater. And I go to the bathroom a lot. I have a bladder the size of a peanut. So I thought, okay, when I go in the bathroom, I'm just going to see if there's a cleaning lady in there. And if she's there, I'm just going to tell her thank you or I appreciate you or something like that. So I just thought, I'm going to do that. So I walk in, and of course, the first bathroom I go in, there's a cleaning lady there. And she's not looking up or anything. And so I go and I tap her on the shoulder, and she just kind of looks at me like, I just said to her, I just want to thank you for, you know, what you do and for making this bathroom so clean and beautiful. And the look in her eyes was just amazing, like, wow, you're recognizing me and acknowledging me, and it was just a joy-filled moment. And so from then on, every bathroom practically that I went into, there was a cleaning lady in there, and I just shared the grace and the love of God, and they were so appreciative, and it was just a wonderful thing for me, and I just thank God for that. And I always just, that movie called The Help, Abilene the Maid, there was something she always told the little girl that she took care of, and then she had to leave her in the end. But it's you is kind, you is smart, you is important. And she told that to the little girl when she left, and she made her repeat it back to her. And so that little girl knows that she is kind and she is smart and she is important. And I try to look at every person that I come in contact with as that. So.
And you do. She does, yes. Good job, Libby. So, this week when you go out into the big world, the holiday season and everything, I pray that there will be many, 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 many thin moments. I pray that you will find them on the streets and in restrooms and in the cubicle that you've gone back to and don't look forward going back to on Monday, but all of a sudden, some way, some practice that our rhythm and our awareness gets thin. I want to do one thing before we close. Just take a moment of quiet. Josh, I need you to come up, buddy. And we're going to do, Josh is just going to play some music. We're going to sit quietly. For you that would like, we're just going to just create a place where you can just sit and maybe consciously think for a moment, pray, be quiet, run through your mind some of the ways that maybe you can make the place you occupy in the world a little thinner for you and for others. Josh is going to play a little music. There's a couple of communion tables set up on the sides, and if you'd like, you can serve yourself. You can take a moment. You can pray. You can go up, and you can just leave the cups there. We'll put a couple of little containers there and just leave them on the table. We'll clean them. But take a communion. I think of the simplicity of Jesus trying to say, here's bread, here's wine. I mean, pretty cool stuff, food and joy and Passover, Exodus, freedom, all these things somehow in him. So take a moment and enjoy the freedom, the closeness, the quiet, the music, the communion. Take a moment, and then when we're done, we'll just have a benediction and we'll go out into the world, okay?